Welcome back to the Paula Gordon Show, conversations with people at the leading edge, certainly no closer to the leading edge than what does liberty mean, what is freedom, what does the Constitution of the United States guarantee?
What does habeas corpus mean?
Exactly, right. Thank you. Well, the habeas corpus is something you hear about in grade school, and they say, oh, well, yeah, and then we do that in America, and it's important.
My recollection in grade school is that that's what makes us so unique and so special is that, you know, as a founding principle of this country, habeas corpus, the right of habeas corpus, whatever that is.
That's right.
But I don't think most of us knew what that
meant. Absolutely central. Well, we certainly, I mean, they put words on it, but at 12, there was some subtlety and nuance missing from that. So give us a sense.
Sure.
You've studied it. Why does this matter? What is it?
It matters because it's the only thing that can, or the, sort of the most efficient and really, I mean, the only, the most durable method, let's say, to prevent indefinite, unjustified detention. Otherwise, the president or any sort of executive authority could swoop people up and put them
in prison.
Or the sheriff and hold them there indefinitely
With
no charge for whatever reason they want to. With no representation. What habeas entitles people to do, it literally habeas corpus means show me the body in Latin, and it entitles it basically compels the body that the institution or the individual who has imprisoned someone to bring the person into court and say this is why you're being held and you know what's your argument gives them a chance
basically
to
basically charge them or release them
sure yeah
which is a fairly unequivocal way of addressing a very serious issue because this is as old as I was going to say civilization but it's not it predates civilization
it goes back to hunter gatherer
this is the power power constraining someone against their will
right yeah and when you think about the roots of this nation I mean that's the idea was very much to get away from the sort of monarchical government and the idea that
it was the idea of some.
Yeah.
Others said, let's relieve me of my taxes. I want to keep the monarchical system. We call them the high federalists, the ultra federalists, the originalists who now reflect that position. So it really is an active conversation. It isn't history. It's history.
Right.
The other thing that I want to say is that at the moment that the Bush administration aggressively made it a point that this was how they were going to do it. They were going to do it at Guantanamo, off American soil, away from. There were people in the military itself to whom the Bush administration had signed this, and you name names. There's an Air Force, an Army, and a Navy.
That's right.
Very high up. I don't remember how high up. Who say, that ain't right.
The top. I mean, I interviewed the top lawyer in each of the services. I mean, and we're talking about an admiral. We're talking about a general, General Tom Romig, Admiral Donald Guder. These were people who were in the Pentagon on 9/11 when the Al Qaeda attacked the headquarters of the U.S. military. And these are people who were saying, as this trial system was being created, they were telling the administration's lawyers, "No, you can't do this
because
it's not legal. Because these men are entitled to certain rights under the Geneva Conventions and under the Uniform Code of Military Justice, which governs the military. And if you don't, just to take it a step further, and if you don't give them these rights, what kind of treatment are we going to be able to expect for our men overseas? I mean, you're ultimately putting our own troops at risk."
And so that was on the table from day one.
Absolutely, and the administration's response to that was to take the project away from them, basically to sort of box out the military and to have civilian lawyers inside the Pentagon.
Who said?
But all of these people, the military as well as the high level civilians, all take an oath to support, protect, and defend the Constitution.
That's right.
Not the president.
That's
not
right.
The policy. Not
That's
the administration.
Right. Yep.
Not an individual.
That's right.
The oath is to there is also a legal responsibility.
That's
there
right.
there
yep.
is also the danger that you will be prosecuted for breaking your oath of office.
That's right.
This is serious stuff.
Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. That's right. That's they felt very much that that's what they were doing. They were fulfilling their obligations as military officers.
So they got bypassed.
And they got bypassed. Yeah, they got boxed out of the process, and it was...
So instead, the administration, President Bush and Rumsfeld, whose name shows up in Hamden versus Rumsfeld, right. and Cheney, this is the whole administration.
Yes, this is the
declares.
Whole administration. I mean, it was... They basically wrote up the rules for these trials themselves. The president unilaterally authorized their creation, and then the Pentagon's civilian lawyers inside the Pentagon working, reporting to Donald Rumsfeld, drew up the rules for these trials, and without any meaningful input from the military. And that's left them open, vulnerable to this legal challenge.
And the president selected the people who would be prosecuted.
President selected the people who would be prosecuted.
The president himself.
The president
himself. This guy, this person, this individual.
Yes. He think about it, he created the trials. He selected the individuals who would be prosecuted. He wrote up the rules. And he defined the crimes after he had them in custody.
And Charlie said that you're right.
And explicitly denied any responsibility or competence to either the legislative or the judicial branch.
He did not permit Congress to offer any input, nor did Congress try.
I don't mean to be simple-minded, but this seems to fly just screamingly in the face of everything that the United States Constitution and pretty much what at least I grew up to believe, but have come to understand.
Yeah.
The legal system under which we exist as a nation.
Yeah.
Am I overstating that?
Not at all. Who writes the laws? It's the Constitution tells us that Congress writes the laws.
And the judiciary has a role in this
exactly.
as well.
Exactly. The judiciary and in the Bush administration's, according to the Bush administration's perspective on this, the judicial system, the judiciary couldn't even review these decisions because they were taking place outside the jurisdiction of the federal courts, so they were out of the picture, and Congress wasn't invited to participate. And unfortunately, frankly, I mean, Congress shouldn't have needed an invitation. I mean, Congress
they should have been on an. Unfortunately, though, at the time this was starting, the Republicans were in control of Congress, so there was.
Yeah, it's true. Though I mean, there wasn't a whole lot of movement.
The Democrats didn't perform. There's not much glory to spread
that's,
around.
There's
another piece of this that I. Just in terms of the context, I am knowing how this came out. Sort of, I mean, knowing where it came,
yeah.
I mean, knowing the decisions at least, I am still sort of sitting, reading this, sitting on the edge of my seat because it is all so tenuous.
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
There are a very, very small number of individuals who, had they chosen not to do something, had they made different decisions,
that's right. yeah.
had they not worked that extra hour, had
yeah.
they not had an inspiration, had they
yeah.
not done another moot court, had they not done any one of a thousand different things.
That's right, yeah.
Under the English common law system that we operate under, the laws that we live under in this country would be radically different today than they are because of just, it's not pure luck because there's serious integrity involved in
right.
this, but it is amazing to me just how thin
yeah.
and terrifying.
Yeah, it's terrifying, but at the same time, I find it sort of inspiring, and in a way, it is kind of a reaffirmation of this country's, the constitutional design of this country, because yes, Congress didn't do its job. Congress should have stepped in, but what happened was that two men, a lawyer, a law professor, an Indian, a child of immigrants, I mean, a man whose parents came to this country, his father came to this country with $8 in his pocket.
Because that's all that the Indian government would allow
exactly.
him to take out of India in 1968 or something.
Exactly. Slept in his car. An officer of the U.S. Navy brought this lawsuit against the commander-in-chief during a time of war, and they got a hearing at the Supreme Court.
Tell me one person doesn't matter.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And I think, in a way, it's this heroic act of patriotism, and obviously, these individuals deserve so much credit, but, you do, I think, it's easy to forget that, it does say something great about America that can happen, that even in this, that this country was designed in such a way that, even when the executive is overreaching to this, really kind of unprecedented degree and, violating his oath to uphold the Constitution, and Congress has, basically run away with its tail between its legs, you have a couple of individuals who can stand up and say, this is wrong, and you have a Supreme Court that will say to the president during a time of war, you know what, they're right and you're wrong.
And it's also interesting to me that so much of this was done pro bono.
Oh, yeah.
The JAG, Swift, that was part of his job.
That's
Everybody
right.
else is doing this pro bono, and we shouldn't leave out the law firm in Seattle.
I was going to say, Perkins Coie.
Yeah. They put, the equivalent of just, millions and millions and millions of dollars into this
and case. Stuck with it.
And this is a firm.
And it was hard.
It was. And, yeah, they stuck with it, and they had to deal with the obstinance of Katyal, who was the real architect of the lawsuit, who, they would spend days reworking his briefs, and he would say, you know what, I'm not going to take any of your edits. And they just kept coming back for more. And, the incredible thing about this firm at Perkins Coie, they're based in Seattle, their biggest client is Boeing. And here, the single biggest supplier of airplanes to the U.S. military, and here they are taking on this case pro bono and pouring millions of dollars into it.
So. And the law students.
And the law students as well.
And it's not quite the same agony for them because this had to be a major learning experience for the law students at Georgetown and Yale.
Mm-hmm.
Many, 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 many hours, and probably didn't do as well on some exams as they might otherwise have. But the pro bono part of this is to me very important.
Yeah, it's
and in some ways... Yes, it's a source for optimism. Damn, it's thin.
Yeah.
I mean, it was very, very close.
It was very close, yeah. You know, I mean, it's easy. You know, you can look at it either way. I guess I just, I just found it was very difficult not to kind of get caught up in the sort of the heroism of the story and the fact that, that they were right and that they won and that, that things
doesn't happen all the time.
No.
Well, and it doesn't happen all the time. We're going to come back with a good deal more with Jonathan Mahler, who has done a great service writing. The challenge, Hamdan versus Rumsfeld and the fight over presidential power. Bill Russell, I, Paula Gordon, Mr. Mahler, we'll all be back in just a moment. Please join us.